You are now tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Want to know more about the channel? Find us online at cjsf.ca.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're going to talk about perverts, punks, weirdos, furries, queers, kinkos, night shift employees, and everybody else who had no place in the mainstream, but who once had a place that was just for them.
It was like, I got a job specifically so I could do my hobbies and have access to photocopy machines, computers, laser printers, all the things that at one time were actually quite expensive.
We're going to talk about what was once known as underground culture. We're going to talk about zines. Wait for it. What is Gavin McInnes, racist hipster and founder of the Proud Boys, now a registered terrorist entity, what does he have in common with Jonathan Goldstein, creator of the heartbreaking and hilarious podcast Heavyweight? Here's what they have in common. Both of them got their start in zines. Gather around the lava lamp, kids, and I'll tell you of the time before weirdos obsessed with, I don't know, obscure Japanese noise rock could just instantly search and find other weirdos who like the exact same thing. We're going to talk about a time before you could say anything you want to anyone who cares to listen. I'm talking about the 80s and 90s, mostly, when mainstream culture was all-powerful. At any point in time, everyone was watching the same two TV shows, listening to the same two albums, and reading the same two magazines. And if that didn't work for you, if you were weird, well, first of all, back then, weird people were really and truly weird. They stuck out. Queers, punks, geeks, they were not celebrated. And if you were one of them, if you were into hardcore or underground comics or skateboarding or radical politics or any one of a thousand different alternative fixations, well, you had to work at it. You had to fight to be weird. You had to seek out weirdness and weirdos. And a way that you did that was through zines. Homemade, photocopied pamphlets about anything, everything. Handwriting, drawings, paper and glue, and then you sneak yourself access to a photocopier and you run off a few dozen copies and you staple them yourself. What the hell do you do with them? We mailed them to each other, to other people who wrote zines. They would put their address in the back, and we put a stamp on the envelope, and we put it in the mail, and wait, often for nothing. We'd give them away or sell them for a buck at alternative press fairs or at punk rock shows. There might be like one comic shop or bookstore or weird video rental place in your town that would sell it for you, all on the same rack. Nobody went viral. Nobody made money. None of us were influencers. But thousands of people did this. And when we did, well, who even cared? Who even noticed when some teenager shouted into the void? Broken Pencil noticed. Broken Pencil cared. For 30 years, Broken Pencil was the magazine about zines. It was sort of a Canadian version of Fact Sheet 5, but it was also its own thing entirely. And over the course of those 30 years, Broken Pencil reviewed over 10,000 zines. They would review anything. That was the deal. If you published a zine and sent it to Broken Pencil, they would read it and review it. You existed. There was proof. Your fetish, your secret, your love of that band, your rage at the machine, your stupid comic strip. It existed. You existed, and maybe some other weirdo out there would notice. Maybe they'd send you their zine. And back then, it is worth noting, all of these weirdos, they were all kind of on the same team. Like, kind of. I mean, straight-edge skinheads had little in common with poetry goths, and skate punk stoners had little overlap with radical dykes, but everybody was on the outside of the mainstream, and everybody was welcome at Canzine. And everyone could get a review in broken pencil. And the other month, it died. Hal Nedwiecki, founder and co-publisher of Broken Pencil, put it this way. I'm going to read here. What began as a platform for creativity and free expression has been undermined to such an extent that it no longer reflects the values it was built on, and I can no longer pour my heart and soul into its publication. The values of the zine and small press community have shifted. In recent years, the relentless pursuit of ideological purity and identity politics has overshadowed the core mission of Broken Pencil. Recent events, including online harassment over my personal beliefs, a petition demanding that I resign from the publication I founded, that the magazine formally support the boycott, divestment, and sanction Israel movement, and devote an entire issue to the conflict in Gaza, and the withdrawal of authors and sponsors from our Canzine festivals in Ottawa and Toronto are emblematic of a broader issue. This cultural environment has become incompatible with the values of free speech, independent thought, and meaningful dialogue. Hal is going to join me here in the Canada Land studio in a minute, and we're not going to talk about Israel. I've read the social media posts that he's made about Israel and Gaza, the ones that turned so many of his fellow weirdos against him. I read them not to determine if Hal was right or wrong, but to see if there was anything that he said that justifies silencing him, justifies boycotting him, justifies kicking him out of a community that he spent 30 years contributing to. There was not. So I did not ask him to come in here to explain himself or justify himself. We are not here to bury. We're here to praise. We are here to recognize and understand the contribution that this guy made to Canadian media over the course of three decades. Hal made space for everyone's opinions until last year, when people decided there was no space for his. And Hal Nedwiecki, novelist and founder of Broken Pencil magazine, joins me in a minute. Wait for it.
When we say the Xerox 914 makes copies on ordinary paper, we mean ordinary paper. For instance, office stationery.
So you've been to school for a year or two, and you know you've seen it all. And at his coming, and you'll go far back east, your tide don't crawl. Play at Mickey Jazz to parade.
How about plain bond paper? Now, if that isn't ordinary enough, wait a minute. To prove the point, I'll cut up some brown wrapping paper.
It's a holiday in Cambodia. It's tough kids, but it's alive.
How much more ordinary can you get? The Xerox 914.
I want to show you something. I'm going to get you to read something here.
Okay.
This is from the Broken Pencil website. This was published in 1995.
Yeah, it was. Okay. Wow, it has been quite a fight for punch First, the principal tries to squelch what has to be the most vibrant and interesting newspaper written by and for high school students I've ever seen. Then, the media jumps on the bandwagon and confuses everyone. And finally, Punch settles down to publishing an activist newspaper that takes on all aspects of the education system in Toronto and Canada, without forgetting that high school is about having fun. Jesse's an obnoxious entrepreneur with a soul. And Punch is a model for anyone, not just high school students, looking to shake things up and have a good time doing it. Newspaper, publisher, Jesse Brown. Main creator, Jesse Brown. Free. And then there's an address. What was that address, Jesse?
That was my dad's office.
Sweet. 108 on St. Clair Street.
Yep.
Does he still have it?
No.
No, you can't go there. And that's amazing. I think I wrote that.
You wrote my first review ever. That's the first time anybody ever reviewed anything that I did.
There you go. I made you. I made you what you are today.
We have issues then. I have a problem with you then. I was wondering who to blame.
Review. Sleepy Hollow Motor Inn. Issue 100. If you, like myself, crinkle a brow at the terms true crime and ruin porn, have no fear. Young breathes life into her tale of homicide, hemophilia, Cape Cod motels, and underwater exploration.
Montreal Fish. This issue, Lewis writes about visiting a really scary neighborhood of Cleveland, packed with illegal factories and liquor stores selling malt liquor quarts for $1.29. Then there's the personal type stories by other contributors, like Alex Megalis on a shoplifter who goes crazy when he gets caught. Huge section devoted to the Quebec summit protests. Interviews, fiction, comics, and more.
You know, maybe once a year I'll go to a party. I don't like people, but you know, the wife will make me. And there'll be someone will come out of the corner and she'll say, I published this poetry zine in 2004 and you guys reviewed it and it changed my whole life. And I was like, oh, it must have been a really good review. She's like, no, not really. But just to be seen, just to, you know,
you exist. Felt. You exist.
Like yeah. No one else cared. That's amazing. I love that. It's the silver lining of the end of Broken Pencil is that I'm getting some beautiful notes from people just saying, you know what, like, you did something important and it changed my life in some tiny little way. And that's a, you know, that's not that, that's the unquantifiable. Did I make any money? No. You know, did I make any friends? No. Did I make people's lives just a tiny little bit better and hopefully make Canada a little bit better? You know, I think so.
I think so, without question. Thousands of people, what is the act of publishing something but you're like kind of a cry out into the darkness and hoping that somebody hears it? And that was kind of your role for three decades.
It was a privilege. It was a hard fought thing to keep the magazine going through some of those decades. There were some good times and some bad times. I mean, like, here's the, I brought you the first issue. Oh, look at that. That's a beauty page right there.
The Lucien Bouchard flesh-eating zombie doll.
With removable leg. And that was the kind of Canadiana that you couldn't find anywhere else. Like, someone's literally making a Lucien Bouchard flesh-eating zombie doll with removable leg, which, that's beautiful stuff.
There are a lot of comics in this zine, including the unforgettable Ackerman Dick story and Sean Bristow's Just When I Thought I Had a Grip on Life, Love Rams Its Fist Up. Oh yeah. Anyway, Rob's family obviously has a knack for self-confession because the prose that pushes this zine into the limelight where you can see the zits and loneliness are by Rob and his mom.
So we have to remember that all of this predates all of the digital tools that made it easy to make something like this at home.
When you look at it, you got to think there's no scanners in the world yet. There's no desktop publishing in the world yet. So we're doing all this, you know, it's cut and paste.
What did I have? I had like a little, like a glue pot that was like you could stick it and then restick it.
Yeah.
X-Acto knives. And
gluing things onto light boards, and then you would take a picture of it, and then you know, eventually you'd have a whole magazine and you'd send it that way. So it's a totally organic evolution that's also technological. So you have sort of the Gestetner and the electric typewriter and things that make it a lot faster to start producing these materials. And then, of course, you have in the 70s the emergence of the ultimate zine technology, the photocopier.
If seeing is believing, let's actually make copies on our ordinary papers. We'll put them here in the paper loading tray. We push the on button. Let's make a copy of this page from a book. That's right, a page from a book. Perfect copies. It takes an extraordinary machine to make copies on ordinary paper. The Xerox 914.
Yeah. And that changes everything.
It changes everything. I mean, you can just go in and make 100 copies of a 12-page booklet. That's basically 8.5 by 11 paper folded and copied on both sides. You know, in 2 hours, you can have 100 copies.
How many weird punk kids, like, got a job at Kinko's so that they could go and do this?
I mean, there is a huge slacker work zine ethos.
Yeah.
Where it was like, I got a job specifically so I could kind of do my hobbies, you know, and have access to photocopy machines, computers, laser printers, all the things that at one time were actually quite expensive.
Like I came into it late, I guess, but it was like, you know, cooler, older kids in high school. Somebody gave me a copy of Infiltration.
Mm-hmm. The zine of going places you're not supposed to go. By the late, great Ninjalicious.
Infiltration. Not simply a zine. It's a reference guide, an instruction manual that deserves pride of place between back issues of Popular Mechanics and Better Homes and Garden. Ninjalicious and crew give us the lowdown on sneaking into every Toronto hotel, rec center, and pool area of note. Maps and suggestions for appropriate dress are included.
I thought it was the coolest thing I ever read. It was like, there's a secret subway station, and I broke into it, and here's what I saw.
Yeah.
There's a secret shopping mall. Here's how to get into this office building, and not to vandalize it or be a thief, but just a different way of being in a city, just like this very subversive way of...
Of looking at your world. I've been in the water pipe system under Toronto.
Uh-huh.
That was one of the things that he advocated for. Terrifying. We hiked in. You know, the pipes get smaller and smaller. And then there was like this kind of interior waterfall. I'm like, oh, my God, get me out of here.
Yeah, it gets intense.
I mean, he was a great figure. And he was very emblematic of the zines of that time, kind of 90s, I guess, where you had a passion and you wanted to share your passion, and you also were forming kind of community and starting to use the internet as well.
Before that, it was really like young people mailing each other.
Yeah, I mean, can you believe it?
Yeah.
Especially now, you know?
Yeah.
but
that's like, I don't know, it was part of a larger culture too, which was that would, like, I guess, hardcore, where... The promoter would be some kid in a town who would put the band up on his couch, and that was all done through the mail and punk zines as the method of communication and information.
There was actually a zine, a kind of magazine called Book Your Own F'n Life.
Book Your Own F'n Life. Ever wanted to travel on the cheap, crashing for free, eating organic, rocking it with the best indie bands, and avoiding the usual tourist traps? Book Your Own F'n Life. The do-it-yourself resource guide spawned by the magazine Maximum Rock and Roll in 1992 has now gone online. Although it was intended for use by indie bands wanting to book tour venues, BYOFL is so much more than that. It is a veritable treasury of alternative travel sites.
And it was the zine of kind of hardcore touring bands.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just sort of list all the different venues where you could potentially book a show, get someone to feed you some vegan chili, and then they'll let you sleep on their floor. I mean, it was just very hard when you think about it. I'm going to book a tour across Canada and the U.S., and I'm, you know, we're a bunch of 20-year-olds in a hardcore band. It's hard, you know, how do you wrap your brain around that? Like, you're just going to show up somewhere.
Yeah.
You need something to kind of build on. So you would find a zine, and it would sort of be like, we're the punk rock zine of Dayton, Ohio. If you're a punk band anywhere in the world and want to do a show here, this is how you'll find us and we'll set you up. And so the word would sort of spread in that really small, granular, cool way.
Compendium of artists, writers, and the kind of people who you wouldn't condescend to label. A sick, wonderful story by some guy named Jonathan Goldstein. It's called I Am Dick Clark, Said Pops, and says more in 400 words about the uniquely male antics of perverse lust than anything I've ever read. Fish tears the roof off your skull. It's like the renaissance of depravity, the enlightenment of perversity. Dare I say, the best minds, the most addled bodies of our generation, all in one f***ing zine for two lousy, stinking dollars.
Jonathan Goldstein, you know, he went on from zines to This American Life and Wiretap and Heavyweight. But Hal, you can't just claim the ones you're proud of. Do you know who is one of the most, I don't know, influential voices to come out of Canada of our generation who started with zines? Gavin McInnes.
Gavin McInnes.
Pervert,
yes.
Comics.
That's right.
Before Voice became Vice, there was Pervert Comics.
Reading the letter section of Gavin's Pervert is a good way to get introduced to some of the great indie Canadian comics. Gavin at his worst and his best. Obsessed with women, wearing nothing but knee-high red socks, obsessed with not being punk enough, and missing the action, all while lovingly and somewhat truthfully chronicling his search for sexual expression and freedom.
There was a lot of blurring of shock value, pushing the boundaries, machismo, lurid sexuality. And it wasn't just in the kind of what you would call the straight white male world. This was also going on in the queer world with like G.B. Jones.
However premature a history of queer zines is in the grand scheme of things, there is the sense that something important, unique, and almost unprecedented occurred in the mid to late 80s that we are still trying to assess and come to terms with through the photocopied pages of today's queer zines.
There was like a lot of zines about like tying people up and doing things to them sexually. And this was a time of where a lot of this stuff could not be expressed in the mainstream. You know, there was kind of BDSM romance novels like there are now.
Right. But like, that's the thing is that like, it's great that we can talk about that now, but the way that we talk about it is like very anodyne. Like BDSM is now something like in an airport novel. And back then, like weird stuff was weird. And, you know, I think it has to do with who you're talking to. Like if you are speaking to the mainstream, like in an airport bookstore, or if you're on YouTube talking about your mental health issue or your weird sexual fetish, then you're going to clean it up. Like, hey, everybody, I've got nothing to be embarrassed or ashamed about. This is who I am. Great. I'm so glad. But back then, you were not talking to the mainstream. Like, this was weirdos making stuff for other weirdos. And it reveled in the stigmatization, you know? Like, the content was depraved and offensive on purpose. Isn't that funny how it's flipped? Because the content back then was like vulgar and abrasive and toxic, but the culture of the content creators, like, you would not think that they would be so wholesome when you met people who made underground comics or weird zines, but they were always so welcoming. And like, even different groups of radically different vulgar and offensive content makers were always super like, hey, welcome, I just made a zine, do you want to trade zines? Everyone was like super wholesome. And now it's flipped completely. You know, the content now is wholesome, and the culture is now super toxic. The cultural context was very different back then.
You can't really understand anything about that culture because it's pre-internet, and the ability to just say like, oh, I'm interested in this, and you type it in and up it pops, and you know, now you know where to go to find out more about people who like to dress up like frogs and be racist, or, you know,
right,
or dress up like bunnies and be chased together and, you know, drink non-alcoholic bunny cocktails. You know, there's everything, you find it now. When we started Broken Pencil, we were kind of like, we'll be the internet.
Right? Yeah.
That was the idea. The idea was
making
way to find these things.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So I guess Broken Pencil was like, that was the actual like reference point for the index of it. And like, things coexisted, like, that now we're in just completely different camps. Like, there was always something a little bit fascistic, like hardcore, you know, Old Man Rollins. And like, you know, like, there was like, you know, I remember trying to divine like, what's an anti-racist skinhead from what's a Nazi skinhead? And like, who are the good skinheads and who are the bad skinheads? But, you know, like a Rollins who now, like, if he was like around now, he'd be like an incel or something.
Right. Well, then he got into like, you know, pure shock value, gore movies.
Yeah.
You know, and sort of.
But back then he was touring with Bad Brains with like a Rastafarian punk band.
Yeah. You could do that back then, because you weren't sort of immediately pigeonholed into this or that. Because first of all, a lot of people hadn't heard about you. Things are spread slowly and not so much virally, which we imagined to be this incredibly fast spread. It was more like ants digging a tunnel. You know, the procedure was a little slower.
By definition, like, almost just in order to have enough people to have things, like, you couldn't be picky. It was completely against the ethic of it to say, we're not about that kind of group of people, or we're not about this, because there just weren't enough. Like, it really was about like an assembly of weirdos.
Yeah. And it was just like,
and if you're going to have a party for weirdos, like, there's going to be some weirdos there.
You had that feeling of the potentiality of, you know, stumbling across things that you didn't know about, didn't understand, and not in a kind of like, I'm not allowed here way.
And it was, I think, things like diversity were not like ideological principles. They were just kind of like necessities of like, if you're going to have an assemblage of weirdos, they're going to be really diverse. They're going to be very different. You can't get all judgmental about gay people or about this race or that. Like, it's just, we're all going to have to hang out here. People are going to have weird, extreme ideas. What's the point of losing money on an independent publication just to say something that's kind of like neutered and like, you kind of have to shout.
No, I mean, your whole point is to go out there and
kind of, yeah. You know. So if you're going to shout and you're like, the sexuality is on display, or like, it's going to be about some weird fantasy, or it's going to like, if you're going to be that way, you can't turn around and judge the person who's being that way in a different way. It was sort of inclusive and accepting and diverse, but not in a way that I think anybody was like, we're so inclusive and accepting and diverse. It's just how it had to be.
No one ever formulated it that way. No one ever was like, my zine is about POC, queers, you know, like, it was just, here's my zine and I hope you like it. And I'm super enthusiastic about this. In that first 15 years or so of making Broken Pencil, I don't recall anyone ever being offended by another zine so much that they would come out and say, oh, guys, look at this horrible thing. This has to be dealt with. We have to shame this person out of our zine culture. I just don't recall that ever happening.
Yeah.
There was definitely kind of like some male machismo zines that offended some groups. But there was that sort of general understanding, like, okay, you're doing your thing, I'm doing my thing. You know, I'm not censoring you. Maybe I just don't want to look at this, you know? But of course, if you don't want to look at it, you don't have to. No one's forcing you to look at something, especially in the zine world, where you have to go out and find it.
Yeah.
Getting back to the core of this whole idea of kind of almost the pre-internet greatness of the